Welcome to the SaaS Sales Performance Podcast, the show for anyone wanting to be on the cutting edge of SaaS tech sales. We provide the tools you need to take advantage of the rapidly changing sales environment. We bring you the leading experts on the front lines of SaaS sales and distill down our famous masterclasses into bite-sized practical tips. Your hosts will be Ash Ali and Matt Milligan. And on this podcast, we will be transforming your ability to sell more and smash your targets.
Welcome back to another episode of the SaaS Sales Performance Podcast. And as we draw 2023 to a close and we enter 2024, which is when we're recording today's episode, we're going to be diving into a topic that is very much front of mind for lots of the enablement listeners that tune in on a weekly basis to the show. And that topic is ROI. So we're going to be having a discussion today with a very experienced enablement leader, someone who I've got to know in recent times, who has a super impressive journey in the enablement profession. So amazing experiences that I'm looking forward to diving deeper into on to today's show. So without any further ado, introducing today's guest, who is Oliver Tate. And Oliver is the Global Head of Growth Enablement at Dentsu. Oliver, welcome onto the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Matt. It's a pleasure to be here.
You and I have had some great conversations in recent years, and I very much enjoyed sharing perspectives with you over the broader enablement space. Before we jump into some of the themes for today's chat, Oliver, I always like to get started with a bit of context. You know, how did we get here? You know, what's your journey into enablement been so far?
That's a really interesting question, Matt. And I think when you talk to salespeople, you ask them and nobody said, well, I intended to be the chief revenue officer or chief growth officer or prior in sales. And sometimes we just find ourselves doing something which we enjoy. And that certainly happened to me. I started out as a computer scientist way back at the dawn of time when we still had punch tapes and paper cards and things and 8K of core memory. I spent my time working on and implementing on and consulting in large computer systems, working with one of the big six, as it was at the time, consultancies. Then spent my time working with systems houses and decided that I enjoyed working on the sales side more than I enjoyed working with the bits and bytes and the twiddly bits, but I still kept that under my belt. So went through account management, business management, bid management for, again, large multi-million dollar contracts, both public sector and private sector. Did some more consultancy around that and then ended up working at a large tech company to start up a consulting business to start with. So again, consulting in there, but selling consulting into the finance industry, certainly in the north of England. And then as kismet happens, I took a sabbatical for a year to go and look after training development for our consulting business. And as I say, I never went back. Long story short, I embarked then on a training mission and started doing consulting training, which then evolved into sales training, sales skills training. I retrained as a psychologist on the way, did my master's in coaching behavioral change. And here I am now through a number of other jobs, having left the big tech. And I think we met when I was VP of Revenue Enablement at an online retailer where I controlled everything from sales ops then through to enablement. And it makes it's certainly been an interesting ride, which has brought me now to where I am within advertising. And I took the advertising job because I didn't have any advertising experience. I wanted to see what it's like in different industry. And I've got to tell you, Matt, you ain't in Kansas anymore. I'm the head of growth enablement because advertising does growth. It doesn't do sales. And the way they work with clients is very different from what we're used to in a tech SaaS business. Both have got items to learn from each other about the way that we approach our clients and the way that we work them.
Yeah, that's a super interesting observation you make there at the end, because I'm also hearing that from the market quite a lot of, should we say, these non-tech industries that are now looking at the tech space and those kind of predictable and repeatable go-to-market motions that they've created, and kind of looking at them quite enviously and thinking, is there a thing or two that we can learn about that? Has that been, you know, part of the journey so far for you in the advertising space?
I think for advertising, yeah, because before I joined, they just brought in Salesforce. So if you can imagine, you know, if you imagine any large sales organization without a CRM system, they would, obviously salespeople around the world would probably rejoice at that, and sales managers would be weeping, but they only recently brought in a CRM system. And then encouraging people to use that and the adoption of it has been a challenge, because as you and I both know, we've spoken about this before, CRM systems don't do much for your average seller. You've just got a vanilla system. All you've got is a record, which either shows that you're doing your job well well and you may be hitting target, in which case you get a pat on the back. But as we all know, the majority of sellers never hit target. So it's just a tool for sales managers to beat you up for not making the calls, not progressing the deals, not moving on, not getting your medic information, whatever it is, it isn't there. And we can probably talk later on how that's improving the lot for everybody and giving, I think, a lot more value back into the system. But if you then take barrier to entry, which is, you know, I'm just completing a system really for no benefit for me. But we don't sell like that anyway, because we've got a relationship-based sale. We've got a very long sales cycle, which then goes into perhaps a call-off contract, and we need to manage that in a slightly different way, as opposed to what would be a traditional, I'll call it a waterfall sales cycle that you'll see in a business where you can identify a need, you can then position your ROI against it, and you can take people down that sales funnel and close them. In the relationship sales, and where advertising is involved, that you're involved with large pitches to win business, it works in a very different way, and the way that you need to start using that CRM system is different. And again, the dashboards and the metrics we get out of it are different as well.
Yeah, totally. I think there's so much to unpick there. And you're right, like, you and I have spoken about that many, many, many times. It does still baffle me how many of these massive organizations are still continuing to operate without a CRM.
Yeah, I think if you think about some of the larger deals, you win a contract, so you work with a client, and especially with some of the large clients where they've been together for a year, they're almost bonded at the hip, and removing your agency is a big deal. So you're not really saying you're managing an account, and it's how you manage that account rather than that sales process, I think, in a lot of cases. And also pitch activity, when it comes together, tends to be quite short notice, orchestrated by pitch consultants with quite a rigid, you'd be very familiar from the public sector, you know, about an RFI or an RFP kind of piece, which then goes through to a weighted ranking evaluation, which then goes through to a final pitch presentation and or, you know, maybe chemistry sessions or idea sessions around it. Typically quite hard to squeeze into a CRM system, which is just used at measuring pipelines and transitions between stages. You know, if you've got one event that happens maybe every 3 years for a huge chunk of money versus something which is expecting a number of events to be happening over that time, or even if you've got large deals, managing them in a slightly different way, the way that you approach it is different. For example, in the SaaS business, you know, we talk about using Medic. It's come pretty well embedded in a lot of businesses, and it's great. It gives you that continual qualification, gives you the continual knowledge of where you are in the deal, if you've got gaps in the deal where it could possibly fall over. I love it. I think it's great. It's great for the sales manager. It's great for the sellers, if they're coached in it, they use it as a tool to enhance and move on the deal and help them spot gaps in it. But try applying that to a, you know, once in a lifetime opportunity. You can't necessarily do those mappings between them. So you have to take different approaches to support them.
Yeah, totally. I think something you spoke about at the beginning of your intro as well was really interesting. You spoke about how your job title in your current role is not head of sales enablement or revenue enablement, it's head of growth enablement.
Yeah.
Which is super interesting, because you know, that suggests to me that something else I'm hearing from the tech sector is, we want our sellers to be much more consultative. Mm-hmm. How can we embed the types of practices that they've got in the advertising or consulting world as examples?
Absolutely. I think if you ask the advertisers, you get the same thing as well. When I joined, I thought it was going to be all Mad Men and Martinis at lunchtime, but I'm sorry to say that isn't quite the case. But it is a long way about building a relationship with your client and your prospective clients and being more consultative. And I think everybody needs that. It's just what you're consulting about. It's absolutely understanding what it's there for. The same questions apply. So say if we're selling to a client that was looking to launch a new product line in India, for example, it'd be very easy just to say, well, you know, what do you want to shift? Well, you know, I want to establish a brand. My expectations are that we get good brand awareness and we start shifting maybe 1,000 units first year, and then it grows 2,000 and 5,000 in those years. And that's great. And many sellers, you know, could walk away from that interaction quite happily. The smart sellers who want to have the consultative sale will say, well, okay, so you're going to sell 1,000 units. Yeah. Well, what does that mean to you? What do you mean? What does it mean to me? Well, what does it mean to you in your position? What will that get you? But also as a business, you know, what are the business goals that you're going to get from this? And you start digging into the reasons behind maybe why they're branching out in India, why they want to put those 1,000 units in there, understanding who the competition is for them, understanding what it'll mean personally, because there's a personal element to every sale. You know, if this fails, what does it mean for the person that you're talking to? And then you build that whole picture up around your offering, and you can pitch your offering in totality rather than just saying, we're going to meet your sales target because we understand this is your sales target, which is quite a bland, non-consultative way of moving. You need to ask more questions. And if there's one thing, you know, that's come out of my experience with sellers is none of us ask enough questions at any stage in there. We just need to be curious. And one of my, I stole this like a lot of enablers do. There's the ABC, what used to be always be closing. And we know that, you know, it's always be curious. We should always be asking more questions if we can. You'll never know enough about your prospect. You'll never know enough about the market. You'll never know enough about the business or what it is they're seeking to get. So that's really where we've got to go.
God, it's so true. I love that. And to steal it from, you know, a customer of mine, Andy at HP, you know, his headline, his LinkedIn profile is stay curious. I think it's so spot on. I quite often observe as well, perhaps less experienced sellers or less confident sellers in those consultative selling techniques. They have quite a lot of difficulty asking sufficient number of questions without just kind of interrogating the prospect, which again is part of the challenge, isn't it?
It is. And you go in there and sometimes it's always happened to me where before, a seller said to me, look, can you just stop talking, please? Because I need to ask these questions. I need to listen more to you. So if you could stop talking so I can hear more about you. I don't quite understand that. What do you mean? They get driven by the questionnaire and, you know, probably back to medic again. You know, I talked about that before. That can be another route that says, well, you know, could you champion me through this? You know, what did you budget? You know, when are you going to do a decision? What's your decision process? And get overawed with in the tick list. Your sales call isn't a one and done. It's the start of a piece of long-term relationship that you want to build. So you need to start to understand the individual that you're talking to and also show them that you can deliver a little piece of value. So show that you've done your homework, show that you've understood their business and be prepared to give them something, because you can't, it's like if you go to a bank straight away and say, I want a loan, they're nowadays they probably haven't got any money anyway, but they'll probably laugh in your face. It's the wrong way to start the relationship. What do we do as sellers? We walk into our customers and straight away we start asking them questions and extracting information from them, you know, almost taking out a loan. Whereas really we should be finding out more about them and sowing the seeds of how we can add value to what it is that they're doing without pulling everything out of them first. So get in there, show your credibility, show you how you can add value, take them on that first step, and then you can start making small withdrawals in that little value bank account that you've built up.
Love that analogy. And these are great insights coming from someone who's been doing this for such a long time. Before we jump in, this is almost part of, you know, selfishly, this is the best part of hosting this podcast, is because I get to just absorb all this wisdom from guys like yourself, Oliver, that have been doing this for a number of years. And before we jump into a topic that I'm really curious to talk about today, which is that engagement and ROI piece. You spoke about on your journey, that process you underwent to qualify as a psychologist. I just wanted to touch on that because I think that's so interesting, you know, particularly on the enablement side of things, when you think about the varied backgrounds that a lot of enablers enter the profession from. I was curious to understand, you know, what have you kind of taken from your background in psychology, and how do you think that's helped you?
Quite a few things. A lot for me. I think psychologists, professional cynics, and you question everything. Why am I doing this? You know, so it's like the police say, you know, check everybody, believe nobody, and double check it again and assume nothing. And that's exactly right. Psychology teaches you to get into the roots of it. You know, where's the paper? Where's the proof? Show me it's working. And if you're then being sold the new wonder technique for collaborative selling, or there's a new magic tool on the market, then it's show me the evidence, you know, show me where it's worked, show me how it works, show me the theory behind it, and show me how I can apply that and how it digs in there. For me, a couple of things the first thing that brought me into touch with psychology in general is working on programs, and we were starting to use a lot of psychometrics. And that's really what got me interested, is looking at, well, what does personality type mean? What does it really mean? And what does it mean when you're selling? And there are pros and cons for many of the different instruments out there. You know, people have heard about Ziegler, they've talked about Myers-Briggs, the DISC model. There are lots out there. They all bring their own little thing to the party, irrespective of how accurate they are as personality tools for your own personality type. We could have a whole podcast on that. I think what it does give you, it gives you a common language and an understanding to perhaps understand people's behaviors. And we know that people behave in different ways in different situations, and other people's, you know, live to the stereotype. You know, a lot of salespeople get high on having a lot of customer contact, getting a lot of praise, being very successful, being very driven. Other people are happier to have a steadier pace of life. They're more controlled. They will be more risk averse. They will evaluate things more before they make decisions. And we know those different types of people out there. Psychometrics helps you do that. And then once you study psychology, you get deeper into it, you understand a little bit more about the cognitive processes that are going on behind the scenes and why that might be the case. But just at the service level, being able to understand personality types and then understand your prospects and your colleagues and seeing how they react when you talk talk to them in a certain way and you give them certain information helps you then modify your own approach to them to best serve their needs. Because if you're annoying them as a pushy salesman, if they don't want to see that, if they want to see somebody that's more considered, speaks more slowly, that has a more data-driven approach to fit with them, then that's what you adopt and you become a chameleon. And some of our best salespeople know that and they do it automatically and they fit in. The other thing that helps me as an enabler is being able to bring in some tools and techniques that have been done in research. So you then look at things, you know, we've all heard about Ebbinghausen and the memory curve and forgetting and knowing the importance of rehearsal and repetition in getting that there and working in context. So giving people tasks that they can do in the context they're going to use them, not just an abstract context, but then refreshing it, repositioning it, putting new spins on it helps people retain that information and also apply it. Because adults only learn if they can see a purpose for it. So you need to couch whatever you're doing in a way that's going to be relevant to them, where they can see, oh yeah, I can use that, I can pick it in, or my colleague's done it, or can see the value in it. If there's very little value in it, it could just be, we're going to teach you how to record an opportunity in Salesforce. Well, knock me down, I'm all over that. You know, there's no value in it. You need to explain the deeper context of what they're going to get out of it. So understanding how we store, process, retain facts and what makes people interested is part of it. And then also bringing in the theory, a lot of the theory of adult learning that, again, is important, but is so often overlooked. And we see it time and time again. You'll expect people to go on a consultative selling program. And as a manager, Matt says, Oliver, go on a consultative selling program, go learn stuff and come back. And Oliver goes away for 2 days in the old days and does a consultative selling program and comes back. And Matt says, well, you've transformed. You're a different person now. You've been a consultative selling person. You must be an ace. And we know that's not the case, because Brinkhoff's done a lot of studies and he's shown out there that just doesn't work. You've got to prepare people for the learning experience. You spend the majority of your budget preparing people for it, and the after event coaching that's there, you spend a small fraction of your budget on the actual event itself, on the learning process. That's almost a minor inconvenience to the larger piece of Matt setting expectations for Oliver before he goes, Matt preparing him, Matt debriefing Oliver after he goes away, having a set of coach activities that does that rehearsal that we spoke about. And if you have people saying, you know, I can deliver this training or that piece of behavioral change just like that, then the psychologist says, don't believe you, you know, show me the evidence, show me what backs it up. And having that knowledge in there is great. And I guess this is my bit to blow my own trumpet. I've come from, I think, quite an unusual background of having the techie side of me is still there, worked in tech until this period in advertising. So I absolutely understand how systems work, how we implement, how we put them together, what it means to be part of there. So when it comes down to the bits and bytes of, say, a CRM system, I understand it, I understand how that works behind it, and also understand what a lot of customers were seeking to achieve. But I've also carried a bag and been out there and run sales. So I understand what it means to be a salesperson, what it means to have that target to strive and to reach it. And now I also understand how we make people better and the learning around it that comes in there. And I think for me, you know, if it was going to be an actor, I'd hope so, as a triple threat, you know, can dance, can sing, can act a bit. When it comes to enablement, there are a lot of people in enablement, and there are a lot of good people in enablement who are just salespeople that have flipped over and said, you know, I can sell, so now I can teach. And we also have a lot of people who said, well, I can teach, so I can teach people how to sell. What you really need, I think, to be successful in enablement is to bring in those three elements. You've got to have sold, you've got to understand the industry that you're in and what you're actually working with, but you've also got to understand the process that surrounds it. So how do you do that enablement effectively?
That's super fascinating. And I'd even go back to the point you made earlier around your psychology background helping you bring that understanding of human behavior. Now, that is something that you definitely, to my knowledge, cannot get from your CRM.
No, you can't. And it's not easy to build up that knowledge. It's back to being curious. You need to invest in your own career. You need to invest in your own learning and develop your own knowledge as you go through. I think looking at a typical sales process, I'll give it, there are some sales naturals out there. You just look at them. They come in, they can work the room, they can control the room, they understand the process, they are super slick. You can see them. That's a personality. That's maybe 10% of your sellers. Then at the bottom, you've got maybe 10% of people who are doing selling because they couldn't find anything else. It doesn't really fit with them. They're not comfortable doing it. They don't like it. They're not there. In the middle, you've got 80% of people who become very, very good and efficient and can become efficient sellers if they invest in the time to develop themselves and develop their skills and learn some of the tools and techniques of the job. And it's all about investing in your self-development. So if you have the enablement opportunities in front of you, if the company's going to invest in developing your skills and you are prepared, again, to invest in yourself, then you'll develop it and you learn it. But you've got to be, always be curious, always be wanting to learn, always be wanting to learn more. And this one thing my family said about me, I can't stick to one thing and I'll learn one thing. I want to go and learn the next thing. I want to go and learn something else and carry on doing things as well.
Yeah, that growth mindset is so important. I mean, I hear, you know, CROs talk so much about that distribution of their team as well. You know, it feels like I'm sensing quite a lot of frustration in the market at the moment with CROs who perhaps don't have the 10-80-10. They've got kind of a bit of a skewed distribution, and they're trying to figure out why so many of their team are resistant to improvement and, you know, are just kind of expectant of pay rises and promotions when, you know, the performance isn't.
And it is difficult to have difficult conversations. I mean, having really tough conversations with your staff about their performance isn't easy. You know, I've done it. I've had tough conversations recently, and sometimes it needs to be done for everybody's benefit. And I would say that sometimes a pip isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's seen as a bad thing. You know, it's seen as a way out, but it can be what it's meant to be, which is a personal improvement plan, which is these are the things that we can work on together to get you better in the business and better at your role, at your job. Because, you know, some people, you know, are great at cold calling. Some people are great at closing. Some people are great at shaving the last 5% off a deal. Some people are great at doing that opening pitch and product presentation. Well, that's great. You know, share the resources in your team and learn from each other and learn as a group and learn where to play your best players. But most importantly, make sure that you capture effective coaching points from your team, because unless you're working with them and alongside them, all you get is a set of data out of your CRM system and or the AI bolt-on, which doesn't give you enough really to have those difficult conversations with about where we're going to go and what the next steps are. And that's really what we've got to do.
Yeah, and you know, through our relationship, you'll know this is something that I'm super passionate about as well, and personally here at UHubs, something we're working a lot with customers on at the moment is, you know, helping them map skill will and that kind of willingness piece is such a big part and a big component of this. But as you said, it's very hard to understand that through just looking at performance data.
And again, it gets back to, you know, we touched on, well, you know, what does ROI mean and how do we work with the C-suite for it? It's the same for everybody. Laundry list training helps nobody. Going in and saying, well, you know, we'll do negotiation, we'll do pitches, we'll do communication skills. That's of no use to any organization unless perhaps you've got a, you know, your IBM in the 1960s and you want a robotic sales force that can deliver the presentation, do business in that way, and that's it. And you're taking complete newbies out of there, you know, almost like, you know, pilot training school. What we need to understand now is, what are we doing to help the business get along? You know, how are we completely aligned with the business goals? Be very clear on what the outcome's going to be and what we're actually doing. And then understand how do we know it's working? What are we going to tie against it? So I give this example quite a lot when I talk. Sales leaders will come to you and say, Oliver, I need my people through a negotiation program. Well, why do you want them in the negotiation program? So, well, because we're losing money on every deal, or we're not squeezing the last few cents out of a deal. We need to get better at negotiating so we can get our margins up. So what you're telling me is your margin's suffering. Why are you convinced that it's negotiation? That's the lever that we pull to get more out of a deal. Well, tell me about how you presented the value of the product. Well, what do you mean? You know, what's your value prop that you're giving before you even get to the negotiation? What have you exposed in terms of your customer's need, their issue, and how you can help them and the potential impact you can have on their bottom line before you even start on the negotiation, so you properly value what your product is and what you're bringing to the table? And then you start having some very interesting conversations. And if you're going to be an effective enabler, you need to be a little bit like Columbo in those, you know, just tell me about this. So you're there. And a lot of the time you'll say, well, you don't really need negotiation. You need value selling to understand how to position your product effectively before you even start having the cash conversation. You need to help your sellers understand more about the business that they're working in. So you diagnose the problem, then you look at, well, how do we fix it? It may be, you know, maybe value selling, maybe collaborative selling, maybe consultative sales. It may be better application of a chest. There are a number of ways of doing it, but you dig into the business and say, well, you know, how do we help people get better at this? Who's doing it well in the business at the moment? Can we model them? Can we use those as coaches? You know, how do we put this in place? And you develop a program, as I've spoken before, you know, which is, this is why it's important for the business. This is what it's going to do for you. You know, if you can get an extra 3% margin on there by doing a better value prop, your commission's going to go up. You will earn more at the end of the day. The business will earn more. So you explain to the seller why it's important. You look at the business outcomes. So we understand that the margins are shrinking, but with a better value prop, we can get into those negotiations in a much better better position. And if we can get another 2% on the margin, this is what it means to the overall business. And these are the levers we're going to pull in terms of enablement and the tools and techniques that we will use to get you there. And you set your measures. So as your program goes through, you can look and see if the tools and techniques are being applied. Then you can look at the KPIs and the measures that you put in place for the program to see that the value is actually rising, that we're doing what we said we would do as an enablement organization. And so many times, especially with sometimes you see external companies come in, they don't set that ROI up front. There is no, you know, this is what we'll do and this is how it's going to go. And you have a conversation, says, well, you know, what if you don't do it? Well, you know, clearly it wasn't our program that was at fault. It was your, you know, the way you worked.
Yeah.
You can't take that at face value. So if you're going to secure a budget, you need to be very clear about what the outcome is going to be. You've got to be there. You've got to have ways of measuring it and tying it back to what you achieve. And you've got to be very clear in how you're going to affect it, what that's going to be.
This is such an important topic. And, you know, it's one that I'm having on a daily basis with so many enablers. It's one that, you know, we get messages in from listeners of the podcast who are talking about this, and many communities that I'm sure both of us are involved in. You know, we often see that question come up. I'd love to dig a bit deeper there, because you just shared a really useful kind of three-step process, if is the way I kind of interpret it, and I broke it down. But before we dive deep into that, I think, you know, just it also, to paint this in a positive light, feels like there is a massive opportunity for enablement here, right? With all of the challenges we've spoken about, a massive opportunity for enablement to get this right and to really elevate themselves strategically in the organization. I met with one customer last week who recently they've actually had their enablement function reporting directly into the CFO.
Interesting.
Which I hadn't heard of before.
Yeah.
You know, but the CFO sits on the board. So you can kind of look at that as, you know, intimidating, and you're really under the magnifying glass, but also as, you know, if you can really get this right, improve impact and as you say, align to those ROI and those metrics that matter. What a great opportunity to elevate.
I think so. I think personally I'd be nervous reporting into the CFO as an enabler, because they're not my, I guess they are my key customer at the end of the day, but your key customer is always going to be the CRO. They're people that you're working with, and they're the bunches supporting. Even if you're doing revenue enablement, you're still really working with that CRM, perhaps one foot into the finance camp as well where you're there, which probably makes it easier to align. However, that said, you've got to prove the value of your organization, which when it comes to the setting a budget, if you're, you know, depends on the size of your enablement team and platform, but if, let's just say, you know, a modest, and may not be modest for some organizations, 500k to a million for an enablement organization, a medium-sized business, that's a huge chunk of change. And what, you know, even if I didn't do any enablement and I employed maybe five extra salespeople, would that give me a bigger ROI than it would with what you're planning on doing and the way that you're planning on supporting the business? So you need to be very careful about how you set out what you're going to achieve, what you bring to the business, and be very clear about why it's important. And we've probably taken it for granted for too long, much as the way that we, you know, we know that schools are a good thing. We know that people need an education, but if you ask any educationalist to say, well, you know, what's your ROI? It's difficult to do. I mean, the closest you'll get, you know, universities will say, well, this is the average salary of our graduates on these programs, and they enter into employment very quickly, and that's it. But you can do the same with enablement. You can say, well, look, this is the average deal closure rate people in this organization before they were involved in program X, and after program X, this is what the deal closure rate went up to. And because we close an extra 1 to 20 deals per seller, it means this much in revenue to the bottom line, which means this much in, you know, in gross margin, and this is the ROI on the investment that you put in place just for that element. So we're back to tying down what we do outcomes and making sure that the ROI that we have in place, you know, it's very easy to try to say, well, if you think education and enablement is expensive, then try ignorance. Unfortunately, that doesn't work with CFOs, because I've been there and we've
right.
said nothing. They've moved out.
Yeah.
It needs to be very clear what you're doing is providing value and showing how it's happening.
The three-step framework that I wrote down as we were discussing, I wrote down the Columbo step, you know, kind of really seek to diagnose and investigate that what you've been asked to do is the right thing. Second thing I wrote down, identify the metrics you're going to move the needle on to demonstrate impact.
I would say outcome. So I would say it's about do the diagnosis, so do the good doctor bit and understand exactly, you know, what are people doing now and what do you want them to do differently? So, you know, where are things perhaps not working as well as it could, but what would it look like things were working well and what we want them to be doing? There's a great question in coaching, you know, people call it the magic question. It goes like this. It says, well, if you went to sleep tonight and you woke up tomorrow morning and the magic fairy had been in, waved the magic wand, and your business was performing exactly as you wanted it to do, what would it look like? And people then describe what the business is or how their life is or where they want to go. So that's a magic question. And if you go on a coaching program, they'll probably charge you $2,000 to learn how to ask that question. So that's one of the magic coaching questions, not denigrating coaching at all, because I am a coach and there are different ways of applying it. But that's a really great coaching question, gets people in that positive state of mind. Understanding how we want people to behave and what that good behavior looks like is absolutely key. So diagnose the issue, understand what we want people to do that they're not doing at the moment, or how they want them to behave, or what systems they want to use, or whatever. And then you develop the measures to show that's happening. So, you know, you diagnose, you plan the outcome, what we want it to look like, and then set the measures. So, you know, if we were closing more deals, what would that get us? What would be the outcome? If people were keeping Salesforce up to date, what would that get us in terms of additional information? What would the leverage of that information give us? And set stats so we know it's happening, so we can see that people are doing it, either for observation or measures or system measures or a combination of both, and then tie that to real numbers. So you know that if we increase sales throw, if we increase margin, if we increase efficiency, it all contributes to the bottom line. But if you can achieve as much with four good sellers as five mediocre ones, then that's better for the business as well. So, you know, how do you bring about that kind of transformation?
I've got two quick questions before we run out of time on today's show, and I have a feeling we're going to have to find time for another episode at some point in the new year. Question number one is, you know, if I'm listening to this and, you know, I'm either an enablement or RevOps supporting directly into the CRO, you know, they may be listening to this. And what would your advice be to someone that's perhaps struggling with the, should we call it, confidence piece, to be able to push back and to be able to do a bit of that diagnosis? You know, well, you know, my CRO is telling me that we need a negotiation program, so that's what I'm going to do. What would your advice be on that one?
That is a super tough conversation to have, because I've been as guilty as other people in being that people pleaser. I mean, we want to do it, and I'll say, you know, Oliver, great, you're here and you're in the job. Yeah, job number one, get the presentation skills program up and running, and it's in there. I say you need to steel yourself and draw on your inner confidence, and, you know, maybe, you know, Oliver said this works, so let's give it a go. Push back a little bit and ask them, you know, okay, if we do the presentation skills class, what will that get you? And what else? Another really good coaching question is, well, what else needs to change as well? How do you see this working? Why do you think this is going to be the case? What alternatives have you considered? And don't be scared to ask the questions and probe around, and not necessarily coming up with suggestions. It's all about asking around. So we're back to the consultative set again, understanding your prospect, understanding their situation, and not taking everything they've said at face value. So be brave, but be gentle, and don't go in and say, nah, you don't need presentation skills. What you need to do is this. That isn't the way of doing it, because we all know that will most likely get people annoyed and position yourself in the wrong way. But by gently asking questions, well, if you do that, what will it get you? What are we seeking to achieve? What would be the measures that we could use to satisfy that? And what else and who else could be impacted, and what could we drive out of it? And be brave in asking questions. Nobody's, if you've shown your value, as we said before, if you made the initial deposit in the bank, you can make a few withdrawals, you can start asking a few more questions, and be brave to do it.
It's great advice. Yeah, great advice. And I love the similarity between the sales approach, because you're selling internally, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, we are selling ourselves. Nobody's going to sell sales enablement to the business. We are in tough times. There's no doubt the business is really tough at the moment. Budgets we know are being cut all over the place. People, it's a very trite saying, you know, do more with less, which again, we're being asked to do. And people will look at enablement. They'll look at all of the nice to have, all the perceived to be nice to have within the organization. And if you're an enablement now, you need to be very careful to make sure that you're showing the value of what you're doing to that business. If you haven't picked up that portfolio of information, shown where you've been attached to specific deals, where your impact has been shown to be effective in a particular outcome, and you gather testimony from the sales managers, from the sellers themselves, and it's there. And just show, I mean, some of the most important stuff that I've done is when I've taken an approach into a business, and we've taken a snapshot of the pipeline, we've looked at it, and we've seen the deals where the sellers adopted the approach that we've said, that we give them specific learning, it's clear to see that their success rate is way above those who drank the Kool-Aid but didn't like it, were not happy with it, or just didn't apply it. And it's pretty easy to see. And as enablers, you need to show that. But then the question always comes back is, well, you know, why didn't they drink the Kool-Aid? You know, why didn't they apply it? And that's on me as well. You know, I need to work on that. So as a sales enabler, people aren't applying the skills. It's not the fault of them necessarily. It could be the way that we're bringing it over. You know, the days have gone. on when we used to be able to turn up, run a 5-day program with a deck of 6,000 PowerPoint slides and people would just absorb the wisdom that you throw up on the screen. Now, we know that doesn't happen. We know through adult learning that that's rubbish, but that's what we used to do. You know, again, I'm guilty of doing that in the past because I thought that was training because that's how training happened to me. But now we know there are more effective ways of doing it. And my job as an enabler is not also to know the business, but it's know how to get information effectively. And if people aren't taking it in, how we help them to do it, or maybe recognizing, again, tough decision, they may be that 10% that shan't do it.
Yeah, completely. The second question I had was just a follow-on to that, and you've partly answered it because you've given me some metrics already, but like, the correlation between initiatives and impact is quite a difficult thing to do, particularly when you don't have a lot of operational resource to spend time in the data. But that aside, any words of advice around kind of what metrics enablers should be looking for? You know, I mean, ramp time has been one that a lot of enablers have kind of clung on to, which is great. But now what I'm hearing from lots in the market is, well, hiring slowed down, ramp time's no longer relevant. What the hell do we do now?
And it depends on it really does depend on the business. I don't think there isn't one size that fits all. You know, ramp time used to be, you know, time to first logo, time to first deal, time to first million was great, and it shows that the people are hitting the ground running. I think the core of that, though, sometimes is the customer sat story behind it. Because, you know, we've all experienced sellers that have been brilliant sellers that have gone out and they've hit the ground running and they've sold millions in their first year. But then once you lift the sheet up and you look underneath and you see unhappy customers, missed promises, bad deals, side letters that you knew shouldn't have been sent. And I think there sometimes is a danger of focusing too much on some metrics because it becomes that North Star that you've got to reach. We've got to hit this level of conversion rate, we've got to hit this level of profitability, and letting that drive everything that you do. So I'd say don't try and focus necessarily on metrics. Look at the elements where you know through your experience that things are not working as well as they could. You know, there may well be in there some immediately sucky things. It may be low margin, it may be low transition rate through stages, it may be longer stage lengths than you'd expect through the pipeline. Pick one and work on it and look at that and see how it moves things along. Then pick the next one, then pick the next one. Never try and build the ocean, and don't choose one metric to supersede others, fight towards it, because you can be sure that salespeople being salespeople, they will find ways to achieve it. It may not be the way that you want them to achieve that metric.
What on? Yeah, that's amazing advice. And what a great way to wrap up the episode. We're going to have to talk about another episode to talk about the AI topic, which we didn't get to, but we can discuss that another day as a conversation for another day. Oliver, thank you firstly for coming on the show and sharing so generously. I've learned lots myself, and I'm sure all of the listeners that will be listening to this over their festive period, sucking into some turkey or the dish of their choice, will do as well. Where can people find out more information? I know that you mentor a lot as well. You know, if people have questions, would like to follow up with you, what's the best way to do that?
Just find me on LinkedIn. I'm sure we'll put my LinkedIn address on here. Follow me or just ping me directly. You know, if you've got a question, I'm very approachable. I'd love to talk to people.
Awesome. Oliver, really enjoy the conversation and looking forward to doing it very soon.
Yeah, let's do it again, Matt. It's been a pleasure.
Awesome.
By uncovering blind spots in performance, motivation, and skills, UHubs helps busy sales leaders at top SaaS companies to optimize their sales enablement so they can develop their reps and grow revenue. The UHubs Pulse platform visualizes each team's development needs, personalized upskilling, and provides data-driven coaching recommendations. These save sales managers 40 plus hours per quarter and help reps to ramp up 30% faster. Supercharge your sales team by booking a demo today.